and Miklala, in addition to being a cardiologist who's been ranked among the top pediatricologists in New Jersey. So it's really a big plus that we can hear stuff that are related to pre-med, medical school, and beyond, especially because I think the Rebbe can have really unique insights for us. So I hope everyone enjoys and gains something from this event.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
An obvious pleasure for me to be here, especially to see all these Torah Shiur guys. Really nice. Thank you for coming. And we'll try to maybe vary the topic, you know, just go beyond the scope of medical halacha and see what else there is after to talk about. I like the form of a Q&A. Because it gives an opportunity for everybody to at least attempt to get an answer to things that are on their mind at various points in their career or pre-career challenges. The truth is, I was hoping to get to see the questions ahead of time, but I didn't. So I think I'm going to open up the floor now to anyone who has questions. If our questions aren't coming forward, then we'll go to, I think Binyamin has the list. We'll go to some of those. So the focus is like this. You know, I'll start with this story. And I think that maybe already some of you, how many people are in medical school? Anybody?
No.
Or pre-med? Who? Yeah, you guys. You know, something that comes up a lot, I remember I used to give a regular shiur in Einstein on medical halacha. And the group there was unbelievable. You know, a couple of guys had smicha already, but everyone was learning night and day. I don't know when they studied medicine. But it was an unbelievable place, an unbelievable atmosphere. And when I would come and give the medical halacha discussions, the enthusiasm level was, like, unbelievable. And it was great for me. It made me excited about it. One day I come in, and it's flat. Everybody's, like, looking depressed. And I'm wondering, whoa, what happened to this great group? Why did everyone suddenly change their affect to such a significant degree? And slowly it came out that what had happened is that they were talking to various people, very, very famous people involved in medicine and in learning. And they had gotten the message, which they really internalized, and it really destroyed them, that becoming a doctor or some kind of health professional was a b'dieved in life. That really, a Jew was not supposed to do that. And, you know, I felt like an obligation over the next week or so to really try to convince them that that wasn't true. And that becoming a doctor is certainly, you know, not for everybody, but for many people, it's a lechatchila, and it's not just a simple lechatchila, it's a fantastic lechatchila. Rav Soloveitchik writes in Long Yemen of Faith, right? Everybody, I'm sure, has at least heard of Long Yemen of Faith, if not read it. So one of the emphases of Long Yemen of Faith is, you know, the whole Adam 1's achievement of dignity and majesty. Those are the words the Rav used. And when he emphasized this, he wanted to give an example. He said the quintessential example of the greatest accomplishment, the greatest dignity, the greatest majesty, is medicine, right? So that, obviously, it's not something that we look at as a b'dieved. And what they were misinterpreting was a concern of certain gedolim, which I'm sure their names are going to come up in some of the questions, that were very concerned that doctors, once they get involved in this heroic mission to, you know, which I think is a good way to think of it. You should go into medicine, if you're going to do it, thinking that you'll be a hero, not in the Gaivadic sense, but in the sense of, wow, what an opportunity to really help people in the most amazing way, whether it be physically, emotionally, psychologically. We can do amazing things for people. That's a tremendous thing. Sometimes people, when they get caught up in it, they lose a little bit, at least many of these Gedolim felt, of their sense of their responsibility as mitzuvim in the other areas of halacha. And that they felt that there's a tendency, you know, there's all these jokes, you know, about the people sitting around the table, and there's the pre-med and Shabbos, and the lights were not put on the clock. Oh, we can just ask him, he's pre-med, he'll turn on the light, you know, like that kind of humor. And the Gdolim didn't think it was very funny. But so that was really where the emphasis was. And the truth is, going into medicine is incredibly halachically challenging. I think, because it always bothered me that when all these Gdolim came down and they would say, why are you going into medicine? You should be going into the learning, you should come to the kolo, you should become go into chinuch, right? When they were pushing that hard, I don't know why I'm looking at you, I'm sorry. So I always said to myself, why are they picking on the pre-meds and the doctors? What about the guy who's a lawyer is going to also do a 9-to-5 or more job, and the guy who's in business is going to be working all day also? Why is it always the doctors that get that mussar? And I think part of the reason is because in medicine, there's like all the chelke shulchan aruch are coming at you all the time. There's just issues involving every aspect of Torah. And there's two ways of looking at this. You could look at it as in a reason not to go into medicine, right? Which was really like Rabbi Avraham. Everyone heard of Avraham Sofer Avraham, Nishmas Avraham, right? Very, very famous. Tremendous Talmud Chacham. You're not allowed to say it to him, but you're not allowed to call him Rav. You have to call him Doctor. You never can allude to the fact that he knows Kol HaTorah Kula. You can't say any of that to him, but he does, and he's an amazing person. And he's very concerned with this issue. And he feels that if he came to this type of forum, he'd be spending the whole time trying to dissuade everybody here from going into medicine. That would be what he would be doing. And the reason he would be doing it, he says, you know what you're getting yourself into? You're going to have to worry about histaklus in the Gia and Yichud all the time. You're going to have to worry about Sirus and abortion and Shabbos and all these things. Everything comes up in medicine, all these things. And to everybody, because just to get through medical school, you're going to have to do rotations and everything. And every one of these issues comes up. So one way to say is, you know, like, I'll take the easy way out and I just won't do it. The alternative is to say, you know, I'm so committed to medicine and I'm so committed to helping people, I'm going to do it. And I'm so committed to halacha, I'm going to learn to the best of my ability as much as I can and equip myself optimally to be able to handle all those situations. I'm going to become a better Jew. I'm going to meet the challenge. I'm going to be a person who's fully an Eved of Kadosh Baruch Hu in every aspect of my life and see it as an opportunity. For me, it was. I think that I learned so much because I was put into this position where I had to confront so many different halachos. You know, tumas, I have to learn about tumah that most people would never go near in their lives. The issues, the halacha lemaisa issues of tumah and nivul hameis and every aspect of halacha. So I think it's something that you should bear in mind if you're a person who's halachically committed, halachically minded, who's going into any healthcare profession or any profession for that matter, to tell you the truth. And I'm very excited about the opportunity to discuss some of the issues that might be on people's minds. So let's start by, anybody have any questions on any issues that they want to raise?
Can we talk about healing goyim on Shabbat?
You want to start with an easy one? Okay, good.
If that's
no problem. Yeah, well, let's talk about it. There are two aspects to that child. One is the practical halach l'maisa element. That's easy. And the other is the philosophical hashkafic one. That's very difficult.
So that's the one I was
after. I know. First, let me get to halach l'maisa, because I think it's important that everybody should know this. Halach l'maisa, there's no difference. And I like to use the expression non-bnei bris. It goes better on Y.U. Torah, right? Non-bnei bris, the expression you used. Absolutely, halach l'maisa, according to all the poskim, except for maybe in the Mishnah Berurah, it's very interesting. The Mishnah Berurah has a very incredible comment in this area about treating non-bnei bris on Shabbos. He says, Hashem yishmerenu, that people are not doing it properly. The Moshe Feinstein in Igros Moshe, he says, Pela pekadosh yomar davar zeh. That's the kind of lashon that Moshe uses. He can't believe that Chafetz Chaim would entertain for a minute that, of course, lemaisa, you could be mechal Shabbos for a non-bnei bris to the same extent that you can for a bnei bris. Right? Halacha maisa, that's it. Mikra din, it's not true. Nikar Din, you can only be Machal Shabbos for somebody who's B'chai Behem applies to. B'chai Behem applies to B'nai Beris. But because it's not just Eva, but there's an Eva of the Pikuach Nefesh that exists, meaning that there's a mechanism called the Eva that's in the Gemara that tells me certain halachas, certain dispensations I could do to avoid unnecessary hatred and unnecessary bad feelings. So usually the Koshi, the Rabbanon, gets nidche by Eva stam. This Eva is one where the poskim across the board, just a who's who of all the poskim that you've ever heard of. And you can see there's a footnote in Shemir Shabbos when he talks about this topic. He has a footnote of about a list of 15 or 20 gedolim that have said, mutter lagamre, because we're worried that if we didn't do it, so somewhere somebody would get into trouble. I had a very interesting experience where I learned the brilliance of Chazal and the brilliance of these poskim in that this is not just a guzma in terms of the sakana that exists. I had once a patient who needed I usually tell this as a long-winded story. I'm gonna summarize it very briefly. He needed a heart transplant. And there was a big to-do. The family at first was opposed to the idea that he should get this heart transplant because they thought it was usur. The whole area was usur. And this itself, if you think that's a controversial question, here's even a more controversial question. If you don't hold from brain death and you don't hold from donating, can you receive a heart transplant? And the answer is yes. The psak is you can. Right? And that's a whole other discussion. But they needed to be convinced of this. So I actually called up Rav David Feinstein, and he told them, you got it wrong, you can get this heart. So here it was, the transplant team had been trying to get the family to come in, but they were saying no, and now suddenly I heard they're saying yes. So I ran down to the transplant office, and I said, okay, they're saying yes, let's go. And usually what happens, lo aleinu, lo aleichem, that you should ever know from this type of situation, but when transplant people get involved in a case, they throw the other doctors out the window, they put on their capes, their big Superman capes, and they come in and they're saving the day. And that's their attitude, and they're very enthusiastic, and they're amazing, and they're tremendous people. They're very dedicated, they'll stay there for 72 hours straight, they'll do everything. Here I am, I go into their office, and no one's moving, and no one's excited, and no, I'm saying something's wrong here. Usually when a family was saying no and somebody says yes, they jump out of their seats before they could change their mind, right? And they were like, oh yeah, they're saying yes, and it was like very weird. So I immediately sensed this issue. So I went into the office with the head of the transplant, and who's a friend of mine. And I said, "What's going on? Why are you doing this?" And they told me that they heard that Orthodox people don't donate organs, so we're not in such a rush to do it for this Orthodox person. Once I said that, I said, "Oh wow." Just that little bit of communication, there was mamish sakanas nefashos for this guy, that there should be that perception. And it's the same kind of thing that they were matir. So the maisa, absolutely no question, and I myself have been mechal Shabbos when necessary numerous times for a non-bnei bris. Now, what you really are asking. You're really asking a philosophical question. So why is it that the dictates of the Torah are that way? There are people that have speculated and attempted to answer this question. I'll give you briefly three approaches to making sense of it. One is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So he says, you can. He says, for a, let's say, certainly a ger toshav, right? There's no such thing as a halacha ger toshav bizmanenu. A ger toshav is somebody who's an ethical person, shomer zayin mitzvos le'noach, doesn't believe in avodah zarah, and then there's an official process, and you need like a Sanhedrin, etc., to be able to have a real Ger Toshav. But let's say somebody like that, who's a good person, who's a Tzelem Elokim, whatever the exact expression you want to use, so Rav Aaron Soloveitchik holds, based on this Ramban in the Sofos, the Sefer Mitzvos, Mitzvah Tes Zayin, says that for Ger Toshav, you can be Mechal Shabbos. Right? They're no different. Right? The whole long piece he has on this. He's really a Das Yachid. He's really an outlier on this. Certainly, Rav Soloveitchik did not paskin that way, although some people have presented him that way. But I've heard from reliable talmidim of his that he did not paskin that way. And No one else does. Most poskim will say what we said originally, only on the basis of pikuach nefesh type eva. So why is it right? Why is it? So Rav Unterman has a nice long essay where he gives the following basic idea. It's worth reading into all the details because he brings rayas that are worth noting. But his general thesis is as follows. He says that, you know, in truth, if you look, the idea of pikuach nefesh was derived in a Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pehe. It's derived also in Sanhedrin. Where do we learn that pikuach nefesh is docha? From Vachayma. Right? We learn kol haTorah kula, except for, you know, the three cardinal sins. Pikuach nefesh is nidcha, right? Or docha all mitzvahs. So then, suddenly, the Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pehe, asks again, well, where do we know that pikuach nefesh is docha Shabbos? Why does Shabbos get its own little question like that? We already took care of this in Sanhedrin. We said, V'chai Behem, he handles everything. And not only does the Gemara ask this question in Pehe, but gives seven answers spanning generations of Chachamim. It's, you know, it presents, it's very interesting Gemara, it presents it as all these people are talking together, but they couldn't possibly because they lived in different generations. It shows this was an issue that was discussed. And to make a long story short, Rav Unterman says what's going on is there's a havanina, there's an assumption that Shabbos should be just like Avodah Zarah, Yehag V'Yavor. And why should that be? Because Shabbos is itself a form of, or denial of Shabbos is a form of Avodah Zarah. Shabbos is all about, you know, recognizing the Borei and the Maniga Olam, right? That's what we're doing on Shabbos. We're stopping our creative activity so that we can think about the Creator, right? That's what Shabbos is. And a person who's Mechal Shabbos is denial of that. And if you Mechal Shabbos, it's denial of that. So maybe it should be Yarg V'Yavor. That's why they needed to go through it again and try to derive what exactly is the source. Why is Shabbos not like Gilei Arayos, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah? And with that beginning, Rav Unterman then develops this idea that, so it's, in truth, we shouldn't really be Mechal Shabbos to save the life of a Jew, either, of the neighbors, or a non-neighbors. But at the end of the day, we derive it. He says that the Torah then will say one of the major reasons that we're going to have this Shabbos being docha is because of the idea of the white Rabbi Bleichel is called the calculus of observance, which means chalav Shabbos achas kidei sheyishmar Shabbosos harbe, which means, you know, we're going to make an equation. We're going to say, all right, we'll be Mechal Shabbos, but we really shouldn't, but we're going to do it. Why? Because in the end, if this person is Shomer Shabbos and he lives, we're going to get a lot more back than we're losing. So the calculus of observance comes out with much more Shmirah Shabbos. So who does that apply to? Right? Somebody who's going to be Shomer Shabbos or has the potential to be Shomer Shabbos. Right? So you're going to tell me, what about a Jew who's not Shomer Shabbos also? So, Enoch Enami, I'll say to you, the truth is, Nikar Din, the person who is a mur lahachis and is mechal Shabbos b'farhesia has the same halacha as an amdei bris. You're not supposed to be mechal Shabbos for them. You're really not supposed to be. They too. The only reason you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos for someone like that. See, it's not a prejudicial thing. This is one of the proofs. The same halacha applies to a Jew who is not acting like a Jew in terms of Shabbos. And the only reason I'm allowed to them, I can't say now. Eva and Pikuach Nefesh. What's the reason I'm allowed to? You need a different head. The Chasam Sofer comes up with a fascinating one. He says there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. He didn't use that expression, I don't think. But he said that Mistama, the guy who's dying, is doing tshuva. So that's our kind of rationale that's going through our heads, that we can assume he's doing tshuva so we can be saving him on Shabbos. It's definitely not a chauvinistic, prejudicial type of thing. So that's the Rav Unterman. There is another, I don't want to go into that, there's already this one question's taken a long, long thing, but there is, I'll recommend something. When there was a big controversy a number of years ago, a famous professor at Harvard Law School came out with a scathing sort of editorial in the Times Magazine, New York Times Magazine. And one of the things, he was ripping modern Orthodoxy, just specifically. And he had his reasons. And one of the things he was killing on was this, and he put it out there. So it was like the biggest chil Hashem because at work I took a pounding on this. Everybody reads New York Times Magazine. And all my colleagues are saying, my non-Jewish colleagues are saying, if something was happening to me on your Sabbath, you wouldn't save me, right? It was like that kind of atmosphere. So Rabbi Lamb came out with an editorial to respond, and you should Google it, you'll get it. He gives a very fascinating other approach to it, but it'll take us too long, so I'm going to hold off. Maybe after if you want to. It's one of my favorite topics, because it's bothered me for about 30 years.
Thank you.
Sure.
How do you advise on handling specifically medical school, where there's no Shomer Shabbos option, and you know, third and fourth year are going to be on rotations on their schedule? So unless you're an Einstein, in which case it's taken care of, but I imagine not all of us.
It's not only, well, I don't think that's true. My experience, and then I started spoken to many, many people over many years on this issue. I never had a problem. I didn't go to Einstein. I never had a problem at all with Shabbos during medical school. You really shouldn't. It's really something that's very avoidable. I think in the majority of programs throughout the United States, medical schools, you should not have to work on Shabbos. You really shouldn't. Now, people might put personal pressure on themselves because they want to make an impression, and they feel that kind of pressure, which I say, you know, is silly, right? From the attending's perspective, I wouldn't notice if a person like was on this day and did. We're really not. I don't know how to break this to medical students, but attendings got so much else on their minds, they're not really paying that kind of careful attention to those kind of things. So if this saves a Shabbos for somebody, I'm doing a good thing now. But let's say it comes to it that they force you. I'll tell you a story. There was somebody who once came to me that. They were on a surgical rotation in their third year. And this topic came up. I'll tell you two quick stories that will really address this, because then I just thought of another one. They were on a surgical rotation, and this guy, the head of surgery, was a former elementary school yeshiva attendee who was one of these self-hating Jews, mahachis, to an nth degree. And he's insisting, even though the policy of that school was you do not have to, if you're a Sabbath observer, you do not have to be on call as a student. You got to remember, you know, no one's, you're not working. It's not a job as a medical student. You're paying big money to go there. They can't make you be Mechal Shabbos. It just doesn't happen. And what and in places where it starts to be a problem, like this person had, you can go to, you know, the administration, and they help you, and they take care of you. And that's really the answer to your question. If you run into it, just talk it up. No, everyone's nice about it to a medical student. Residency, another ballgame, right? But medical school for sure. So what happened in this particular case was they forced this horrible self-hating Jew, chairman of surgery, to not force these from people to work on Shabbos. So what did he do? Right? And here's the downside. So on this particular guy's evaluation, right, these evaluations that go off to the residency programs, if you let it, this guy, you'll see why, did not let this go. He wrote, rule out Down syndrome about the guy. That's like a nasty thing to do. Shows how sick that guy was, right? But at the end of the day, you know, it didn't affect anything and he did the right thing. The other story I'll just tell you quickly was, I'll never forget, I was in medical school with this Iranian Jew who was, you know, used to tell me amazing stories about the horrors of living in Iran, and he got out, right? He was so happy to be, you know, now in a Jew-friendly country coming out of Iran, that I'll never forget when I was like, they were trying to make me be on Shabbos. We were in this little group, he, I, and these other people, and we were making the surgical medical student call schedule. And they were going to say, okay, we'll split up the weekends. You'll do one Saturday. You'll do that, that, that. I said, no, I'm not going to do on Shabbos. And he's like nudging me, no, don't do that. He's like, it was like such a different world view and experience he had. He says, no, come on, we're so lucky to be here. I'm saying, take it easy. You might be lucky to be here. At the end of the day, I convinced him to see it my way and not to have to give up Shabbos, because, you know, we don't live in Iran. In the United States, it really should not be a problem. That's the honest answer to that question. It should always be there.
If I may just ask that, I'm pretty sure it's illegal for any school to make it.
It's not so passionate about that, but it's not one you would want to bring a lawsuit about. I'll tell you that much, because it would ruin your career. So you don't need enochinabi that there are religious objections to many things, right? Conscientious objections. There's a lot of in the medical ethics literature. There's a ton of stuff about this. Not only about this, but not only about Orthodox Jews. There's all sorts of conscientious objections. So what happens is there's a little bit of slippery slope where they will not necessarily enforce this kind of thing. Because somebody doesn't want to, do X, Y, and Z. It becomes a little tricky to just think about it in legal terms. It never comes to that. It never really does.
If I can jump to something you mentioned earlier, how do you respond to the ava that's generated when Orthodox Jews won't donate nor people will accept? And it comes up pretty often.
Well, what did I say to this woman when she said that to me, right? Let's go back to that story. So I said to her, I said, no, you're wrong. And I quickly went onto the HODES website, which I never was more grateful that it existed than then. And I've told this to Robbie Berman every time he comes in to fight with me at Traga. I always tell him how much I love HODES, and it saved this kid's life. Because she said, oh my God, look at that. Now, the truth is, there are people that hold from brain death, right? Not me. I'm with the poskim that's Suffolk. It's Suffolk. Suffolk l'chumra, right? Can't do it tzicha. But, so that's number one. So there are people even that are donating hearts and livers that are from. But certainly, I personally hold it's a big mitzvah to donate the non-brain death related organs, for sure. And that's what I emphasize. And that should be emphasized, and you do everything you can to avoid a chilul Hashem. Absolutely. Speaking of which, getting back to that, this is important not only for that question, but for residency and internship and fellowship. One thing a person could do if they want to facilitate for everyone having it easier on Shabbos is don't be a walking chilul Hashem. There's a lot of that goes on with people in Shabbos programs. You should be, right? Part of the kiyum of Shabbos should be going out of your way to be nice and helpful to the other house staff and the other medical students. Because when you do that, first of all, it's a kiddush Hashem. And second of all, it will, if you need to be utilitarian about it, it will also allow much more giving from them when they see that you were willing to do extra work. You didn't run out. You didn't leave anybody with extra work. A lot of that medicine is just ripe with opportunities to either be really nice or really selfish, right? And there's an extra responsibility to be if you're representing an Orthodox Jew and you're demanding things for your halachic needs and you're wearing a yarmulke and et cetera and doing things like that, you have to really be careful, as always, that you should be a walking kiddush Hashem. And it makes a big difference.
This is, I know, you can use this as a springboard to talk about conflict issues if you want. I was talking to somebody when I mentioned that you were coming. She was like, I've had this child. She's in residency for emergency medicine. She was wondering a lot about touching the zogosistin.
Reminds me of another story.
And, moving that, obviously, if you're trying to heal them, that's one question. But also, if you're just moving them from bed to bed because you need the space in one room, you're moving them somewhere else, the family wants them somewhere else. What can you do?
All right. It's also to touch a ghostis. Big time also.
What's a ghostis?
A ghostis is somebody who's in the throes of death, basically. They're like a flickering candle, is what Chazal say. They describe it as a flickering candle. Now, my very, very first, speaking of third year medical school, my very first experience, I was on medicine. I'm like nervous like anything. First 2 years of medical school is just memorizing, night and day, right? So that's that. Now I'm going to be out there with people, right? And oh my God, this is amazing. All excited. I walk onto I'm expecting there to be like a red carpet ready for me. No one notices. Okay, so get used to it. The medical student is like really on the low. So I walk in there and I'm waiting to somebody tell me where I'm supposed to go. I have no idea where to go. So I'm being a little shy, but then I finally realize, half hour's gone by, and I'm still sitting there at the nursing station. I go, where am I supposed to be? I'm a medical student. I'm that medical student. And it's a giveaway, by the way, the little white coats. Forget, that's the medical student. So they say, go there. Your intern is in there. So they point me to this patient room. I go into the room. I am not making the story up. There is this Nebuch patient who's a ghostess. Now I know really what a ghost is. That was like Chazal's description of a ghost is making these noises. It was unbelievable. So I see that and I'm going, oh, wow, I'm going into pediatrics. But I, over there, cowering in the corner of the room, is this intern. She's like literally in the corner, going like this. I'm like, hi, I'm the medical student. Like, what's supposed to happen now? You know, is that what we do? We go into the corner when the patient's in the death throes. So she goes, no, go get the EKG machine and put it on him. And I'm saying, thank God I had the wherewithal to ask this. I go, why? She goes, well, he's gonna die soon. I want to be able to declare him dead. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't know much medicine. I know a little halacha at this point. And I'm saying, well, he's a kosis. I'm not touching him because you can't touch him. I'm not putting on the EKG. I say, it becomes a fight. I said to her, I'm not putting on the EKG machine. I'm not going to do it. She said, why not? I go, because why don't we wait till he dies and then you can do it, right? Because I said, I think that it doesn't have a therapeutic aspect to it, right? I'm not saving his life. I'm trying to declare him dead, so I'm going to put that. You can't do it. Usser. Under no conditions was I going to do it. She ended up screaming at me, getting mad at me, giving me not such a great evaluation. I could care less. You know, it's at the end of the day, it didn't matter, right? You got to keep halacha. That was that little message. At the end of the day, a gosis cannot be touched unless you are trying to somehow save them, which is very rare that that's what's happening with a gosis. So it's an easy question. Usser to touch the gosis. Usser. You can't move them for any reason other than to help them, right? This is the quintessential Isser. Now, if you want to use it as a segue into end of life, it's the very famous Ramah and the very famous Shilte Giborim and the very famous Psak in Yeridea about that. Let's say there's a Goses there, you can't do anything other than be Mesir Hamoneya, right? Which means that. It's the way the Gemara describes it is, let's say there's a woodchopper chopping wood outside, and that's what's keeping this person, the neshama, from leaving. That's the way the Gemara describes it. It's a very weird sugya to some degree, very difficult to work with. But so you're allowed to stop the woodchopper, and then passively, whatever happens will happen. You can never do anything that might actively hasten somebody's death. It's an act of reticho. It's Yahweh Yahweh to move a goses, just to put it mildly. So, scare her. Not touching any goses.
Does that include moving the bed? Like, if they're in a bed that you cannot move without actually touching it?
I'll tell you, it's interesting. What are you allowed to do? So, where this comes up, actually, is a little bit. Rav Tendler and Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Al-Yashiv had a little kind of, appears to have a disagreement on this issue. What do I mean by that? One of the issues about brain death is, you know, if you can use an imaging study to help decide whether it's definitively brain death. So can you show no circulation going to the brain? Maybe that's enough for Moshe Feinstein's psak. You know, I'm not getting into this whole issue yet right now. But one of the reasons that Rav Shlomo Zalman rejects brain death, because he was ready. Rav Shlomo Zalman sounds ready, if you read him, to perhaps accept it. But he says it's an impossible thing to show, because you can't show this. Because even just squeezing the dye would be disturbing the goses. So that's pretty passive, right? Anything that you're going to do, any manipulation, the goses are not to be touched. So I can't imagine moving him if he's officially a goses. Now, by the way, not everybody is sort of qualified to determine somebody's a goses. Goses really means within 72 hours the person is going to be gone. And, you know, doctors are notoriously terrible at this. Right? You know, it's all the time making mistakes. Reminds me of another story. But maybe I'll hold on that story so you can get another question.
Can you tell someone else who's not Jewish to go touch a goses? Or is that an issue as well?
No, that's you cannot do that. That's Amir Lenachri for Ritzicha. You certainly are not into that. Absolutely, you can't. No one should be touching a goses. Leave the poor goses alone.
Is a man allowed to go into a medical field that only involves women or vice versa?
Finally, like a switch of subjects here. Like that. So, the basis of this question, I'm assuming, is, well, you know, you're putting yourself into a certain nisayon that maybe you shouldn't be, right? It's a good question. So it's actually discussed amongst the post-Kibbutz, this shiloh. Can you, and let's broaden out, can you put yourself in any field? Let's make it interesting for the trial. You guys, they're not really pre-med. They're just here to be nice. So, thanks. Not that I don't appreciate it. Can you put yourself in a position where you are going to be exposing yourself to a nisayon of histaklus and some type of compromising position for parnasa, for a passion to be a certain type of doctor, right? A lot of guys thinking of OBGYN, you know, this is a big shiloh for them. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very, very illuminating tshuva, and the Nishmas Avraham quotes this tshuva with others, with a ritva to back it up, you know, Rishon to back it up, where basically the upshot of it is as follows. It's about, the Gemara is about starts in Bava Basra that the is the Perek HaShutin, it's the first Perek in Bava Basra about what things you can force your neighbor to do or not do. Everybody's neighbors in the Chatzer, and you're not allowed to impose usually things on your other neighbors. You have to be considerate of them, so you can't put in like lime and acid and things like that that will disturb the other neighbors. However, you can have a washing area, like a clothes washing area. Why? Because we want to protect our daughters and wives from having to go to the public washing area where their shok will be exposed. So that's how the Gemara gets into this topic. And the Gemara then says there was a guy who would, he needed to get to work. So, you know, he was, the Shiloh was, they said he was a big, big chassid. Why? A big, tremendous tzaddik. Because he used to go by there and close his eyes. So what was the point? So Rav Moshe derives, without getting into all the Rishonim and the whole sugya, the bottom line on that sugya is, Rav Moshe says that when it comes to these things, to put yourself for no good reason into a compromising position of histaklus, go to a mixed beach, go to, Times Square, whatever. To do these things for no reason is absolutely usur. You're a rasha if you do it. But now let's say you have a tachlis there to do it. He says it's mutter. It's mutter, but only if you know yourself that you can handle it. And he puts the achrayas on the person. And this then gets extrapolated out to your shiloh by some of the poskim, that that's exactly the way they should view their decision to go into a field that might have extra difficulties in this area. You have to say to yourself like this, it's mutter. It's mutter to do. Right? And there's no blanket issue. But if you yourself know, and I once had two guys ask me this specific question, and they came to me admitting that they had doubts about themselves. So I thought, okay, I said, you just answered the shiloh. You can't go. You can't go into it. Right? And there was it wasn't just they had doubts like all of us have doubts, right? It was like they specifically had strong doubts about themselves in a way that I said, you know, Rav Moshe would probably advise you not to do it. But if a person knows, look, I want to be treating infertility, I want to deliver babies, I want to do all these really nice things, that's my motivation. And I know that I can be professional, right? The initials of Ram throws in, by the way, you should make sure you're married, you know, if you're going to do it, right? Make sure you're married. Paspasalo, he gives a whole explanation, very nice. And put in safeguards to yourself. Be very, very makbid on yichud, which everybody should be anyway. Do a lot of things to facilitate safety in this area, but then as long as you can personally vouch for yourself, then it's mutter and
we're down there. And to follow up, what is it good? What's going to do with the mitzvah at the end of the fusion that says that like you shouldn't go into professions that put you into close activity doing that?
Well, it's again, if a person is going to, let's say, going into a field of medicine, right, where they have a passion and they think they could be particularly kind of a mitzvah in that field, is different than, let's say, a stam case of where you're going to just look for parnasa. Right? Parnasa would not be enough of a reason when you can have an alternative parnasa that's not like that. Then that's like rishus. Right? That's closer to that. Like, you know, I could be the lifeguard on the all-male beach, right, in Ashdod, or I can go to Tel Aviv, and you know, so, and they pay more even over there, so like, then you're fooling nobody, right, when you make that kind of decision. That's what that's really referring to.
When you're like confronted with a situation where you have to like, you know, you don't want to compromise something like, for example, a ghost age or something like that, just how, in your experience, how do you gauge, like, when to say, you know, this is my religious belief, like, I can't do that, or when
it's always awkward. There's no secret. Some people are good at it. You know, some people are just, like, good at, like, talking. Here I am. You know, cool. I'm not one of them, right? I was shy and hesitant and felt awkward about it. But at the end of the day, you know, it's a must. So, but what you do, you set yourself up as much as possible. So, for example, like, if it's like a question of, you want to arrange, let's say you didn't get a Shabbos residency, right? And something like that. So, then, you know, some people would say, don't go into medicine, right? But let's say most people, most poskim are going to work with you. And you'll be able to do it. But they will say, like what Rabbi Willig said to me 30 years ago, I'll never forget it. I was talking to him, not 30, I'm not that old. Okay, 20 years ago. I was picking a fellowship. Now, I did a Shabbos residency in Baruch Hashem. Never had to be Mechal Shabbos ever. But there's no such thing in the field I wanted to go into, pediatric cardiology, as a Shabbos fellowship. Just didn't exist. So here was my big shiloh. Can I do it? Can I do it at all? Or do I have to, like, you know, I don't know, general peds? Definitely didn't want to do that. And find something else. So Revolik said, no, here's your answer. You're never going to be Mechal Shabbos. Period. You're never going to be Mechal Shabbos. I said, okay, thank you. Does that mean I can do it? He said, yeah, just never be Mechal Shabbos. So now you come in, and you have to have that same attitude if you don't get a Shabbos residency, right? You have to realize you never, shelo kehalacha, right? You can be Mechal Shabbos kehalacha, which means pikuach nefesh is bilcha daraisas, chal sheim basakana, you could do certain derabanans, and all the rules that you really got to know well. But what you're going to constantly be trying to do is get people to help you. Like, that's your question. So, for example, it comes in two forms. It comes with your fellow house staff people that you want, maybe they should help you with switching calls and do that. And the other place, it actually, when I was a fellow and I was coming in on Shabbos, I wanted it to be a kalakal tchila, which means you want to minimize the averos. So I was having secretaries and nurses and social workers all be my Shabbos guy, right? And until one day, the funniest thing happened, another fellow who's a Saudi Arabian, from the princely family, volunteered to be my Shabbos goy. I couldn't believe it. I said, wow, I can't believe there's not peace between our people. But he made it easy. But otherwise, you have to actually, you know, in New York, it's not that hard, right? In the New York area, a lot of people are aware of it. But when you have Barack Obama saying publicly he was a Shabbos goy for somebody, that's helpful, right? But in all the different, let's say it's not only Shabbos, but other compromising situations like a gosis, like Sirus, or like this. How about this? When I was a surgical rotation as a medical student, so the guy that was going to be giving me my grade asked me to go to the deli and get him a ham something or another sandwich. So first of all, I didn't know if he was Jewish. That was my first problem. Right? My second problem was going to be walking into this totally trade place with my yarmulke and my tzitzis hanging out. It's a little funny. But I had to ask him if he was Jewish. So I just did it. I had no choice, but I did it. I said, with an explanation and a smile, and if you're on good terms with people, it's not as bad as you think it is, and it's not as difficult as you think it is. But you have to be, you know, firm in your principles, establish that for yourself early, and then let's see where the chips fall. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, if I'm trying to read where your question exactly is coming from, like what your concern is.
What I'm really trying to understand is, how comfortable are you with, like, kind of stretching the truth to come up with some type of explanation other than religion to make it, like, okay, meaning, like, let's say you have a person who's dying and you don't want to say that you just can't touch them because of Jewish guy, so you, like, come up with something like, oh, I don't know, like, something.
Let me try that. Wait. I'm sorry, he's going to have to die because I'm having a little bad. That won't be a good religion. I go with the religion.
Being something that would make sense in the context.
Yeah, I hear it. Is there room for sheker in that?
Yeah,
in that, you know, we normally use it in the Rosh Hashanah. I would say to save, if you feel that there's going to be a Chilul Hashem or something like that going on, if that's your problem, then I would say whatever is necessary to avoid that, and whatever is easiest. And I get what you're saying. Yes, sometimes you do have to do that. I did find that the straight up, forward way worked for me. People were very respectful and people were very nice. Other than that guy who went to yeshiva in elementary school, must have had a really bad like rebbe or something. I don't know. But for the most part, I found that usually I was able to explain it. And as long as, you know, I told you, sorry, the setup is being nice and helpful to an extra degree otherwise. Then people respect you. You know, if you represent yourself as a religious person, and then you're selfish and you do all these things, the rest of the time, no one's going to take you seriously, and they shouldn't. And you're a hypocrite, and you're just doing not only Chilul Hashem, but you're going to hurt yourself, because they're not going to say yes. You're going to say no. But do you hear what I'm saying? Like, the setup is very important. Nice to see you.
What is the philosophy perspective on socialized universal health care and privatized
health care? Oh, sounds like a Shriver question. it has a lot to say, and it's very interesting because there is an achrayus for, let's say, the tzibur to take care of everybody. And it's one where the triaging resources and all issues of concerning health would be very much socialized in terms of the way halacha would look at it, very much like in Israel, you know, to some degree. And it actually was a big debate because Israel was having this debate within different settings on whether they should put money into research that would end up benefiting the wealthy, right? People that could afford like the highly specialized types of treatments, highly specialized types of imaging and all that, or no, put the money, the government money, into things that would help get more clinics, more terem, help the common person, right? So like there were rabbanim that were discussing what would be the halacha's view, and it was very obvious. If it's the government, the representative body of the Jewish people, they have to be thinking of the masses of people. They can't be thinking of the wealthy few. But private money, your own, a person's private money, the halacha says you can do with it whatever you want, and you can. It's a very famous story. It just came up when they were talking about Gilad Shalit and getting him out and whether it was worth it to sacrifice, you know, give 1,000 terrorists free and all those kind of cheshbonos, the famous Mishnah, Sugi and Gittin about this issue. And the conclusion was that very much along these lines. For the tzibor, if we're operating as the representative of the tzibor, you can't do something to save one person that will jeopardize the tzibor. However, if the person's family wants to pay an exorbitant ransom, let's say, it's mutter for them to do it. So in a private level, halacha says you can do it, but when it's going to be the government or the representative body, then you're not allowed to do something that would jeopardize. It has to be more equally socialized.
Not to go back to Michal Shabbos, but to also go back. Let's say a doctor gets a page on Shabbos. Is it automatic that they should pick up the phone right away and call the patient?
I have a pshita answer to that, right? But before I do, I want a chance to make a joke about my wife. See, that question's obvious. Now do it in the other way. First, I'll answer your question. Yeah, you're on call and you get paged? Of course, you have to find out what's going on. Until you know what's going on, yeah, it's the kind of fashas, and you have to do it. There's no question about it. The question comes up, though, the one that I was joking about my wife, because we fight about this all the time, in a friendly sort of way. It's gone away, Torah. You don't really fight. what happens is, let's say I'm on call, right? And the phone rings in the house. That becomes the shiloh, because I have a beeper, I have a pager, and now I actually, there's a new system, like they just go right to my phone, and all this stuff. But the way it was for years when I was like a resident, for example, and I had, or a fellow, when I had call that I could have been from home and all these kind of things. So what happened several times, not infrequently, was that my pager didn't work. They didn't get me. The backup is to call the house. Call the house. So I would be saying, phone to ring, and I would be saying, oh, I got to pick that up. And my wife would say, what do you want to do? You going to do Michal Shabbos? I married a from guy, didn't I? And then I said, no, but it could be, I think it's, they might have missed, they didn't get me. Oh, you're just making that up. I go, why do you think? You think I want to be Michal Shabbos? So I was right, because, and this, you're not here to defend yourself. I'll tell you the sugya. There is actually a sugya like this. Very, very important sugya, because this sugya is very useful. You should all listen to this if you're going into medicine. This is, you know, I feel like I've been staring at over here the whole time. Anyone from Mechala? Nice to see you all again. The situation works like this. If, let's say, we all know Pikuach Nefesh, with a Cholo Lefaneinu is Docha Shab, it's Docha everything. Okay. What about if you don't have the Cholo Lefaneinu, you have a Sakana Lefaneinu, which means like the cholera epidemic, right? That's famous where the Shaila came up and all the Tshuvos came out, that, you know, there's no Cholo Lefaneinu, but I know that the cholera epidemic is, this horrible disease, cholera, is coming into the town. We can now be eat on Yom Kippur or do various Yisurim. Yes, Mutter, right? That's the Chazon Ish. What about situations, and this happens a lot, where there's no Sakana right now, but it's possibly going to come. Alulama. There's going to be a Sakana in potential. Where do I draw the line that I can then, like I'm telling my wife, there's a potential Sakana here, even though I don't know it yet. And it might not be, but it might yes be. Where's the threshold? What do you use as a calculation that you're allowed to pick up that phone? A real sakana, we say, ain holchin achayar rov b'sakanas tafashos, right? Suffix, you could still be mechal shabbos, you could still do daraisos. But that's when, you know, there's a cholo lefaneinu. What if you don't have it? So this question comes up in many areas, for example, studying on Shabbos. Are you allowed to study medicine on Shabbos? We'll talk about it in a minute. But can I use the excuse, well, it's Pikuach Nefesh. Sorry, it's Docha Shabbos. It's Pikuach Nefesh for me to study medicine on Shabbos. Right? Some people want to say that. Right? I'm going to show you soon that's pretty stupid. Right? It's not true. That's not a het there. Right? But no, it could be one day there's a patient who's going to die if I don't read about where the various bones of the foot are. If I don't read that, I don't know if that's going to happen. But okay, so that's one shiloh that this issue comes up. It actually does. So it's another place is when you go, let's say you called into an emergency, right? And can I get in my car to go to emergency if I need to get there right away? Of course you can. Now I get there. Can I turn my car off?
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of agreement here.
Very famous.
Yeah. So, why should I be allowed to turn it off?
Because it might stop. If you can't, it might stop you from going in the first place.
That's not a bad one, but no, that's about return. That's hetir sofer mishum chilasim for that reason. But this is something else. This is turning off my car. So, Rav Shlomo Zalman's mechanics told him that what happens if you don't turn off the car is it'll explode. The Tzitz Eliezer's mechanics, right? So I guess, in Shari Chesed, that's where Yerushalma Zalman lived, in Shari Chesed. Tzitz Eliezer is like in a different part of Yerushalayim. So he's more near Shari Tzedek. I don't know what's going on, but his mechanics told him that's ludicrous. And what happens is you just run out of gas. But so there what it became is a springboard for this argument. How much... What kind of threshold do we have for potential pikuach nefesh? When does this come up? It comes up, let's say, you're typical if you're a doctor and you let it out in your neighborhood, and it's Shabbos, and a kid has a fever, your neighbor has a fever, they're going to ask you to check him out, maybe look at his ear. He's tugging at his ear. Am I allowed to turn on my otoscope and look at his ear on Shabbos? Assuming the otoscope is an incandescent light, which is a daraisa, can I do it? Well, what's the argument for it? Well, I could tell you that there are reported cases of otitis media, ear infections, leading to meningitis, to death. So, look at that. There's a potential for death. So, where do I draw the line on the suffix of this thing coming? And that'll tell me whether I can answer the phone, right? So the Tzitz Eliezer is very incredibly chamor shita on this, which I think is ill-advised for the medical community to follow. He says, when it comes to things where you don't have a chol lefaneinu and it's only a potential sakana, hol chinah chayar rov, which would mean you can only do the iser if the majority of times that thing will happen. So if the majority of times I pick up the phone, it really is the hospital calling me, then I can pick up the phone. Most people don't pass. I don't know anyone who passes that way other than Tzitz Eliezer. What Rav Shlomo Zalman said and Rav Shechter says all the time is we use a very different criteria. This is a very useful bit of information. This bit of information was worth the whole night if you catch this. To make all these kind of decisions when you're deciding this potential sakana, does it allow me to be Mechal El Shabbos? You have to say to yourself, what would I have done on Tuesday? Would my attitude of urgency on a Tuesday been enough to warrant then I'll be Mechal Shabbos as an emergency on Shabbos? So for example, I don't think there's too many people that need to read their medical textbooks urgently on a Tuesday as though there's a life and death issue. So clearly that does not allow you, that would not be the reason you could, I'm not saying you can't read medical textbooks on Shabbos, by the way, but that's an independent question. But certainly it's not because of Pikuach Nefesh, right? What about the otitis media? Anyone here have any? No, probably not. Yes, Hashem, you'll have children, and you'll see that most people do not react to their kids having a little fever, that it's a sakanas nefashos emergency on a Tuesday. Therefore, you probably would not treat it any differently on Shabbos. So if on a Tuesday you would say, as the doctor or the parent, oh, you know, I could see the doctor in the morning, I could go the next day. If it's that kind of scenario, then you have to say to yourself, I can't be Mechal Shabbos for this either. I know that on a Tuesday, if I'm on call and the phone rings, I grab it with excitement and urgency because I've had enough experiences where that's what's happened. So that is why I'm right and my wife is wrong. So it's 8 o'clock. Anyone who needs to leave, please go. Bye, guys. It was great to see you. All right. Take care. Any other questions? Let's go to this side.
So you referenced before your decision to go to pediatric cardiology. To what extent do you consider Shabbos, let's say, or and enjoyment on the other side, or you're passionate about something, but it could potentially get in the way of halacha? To what extent do you weigh those factors when choosing a specialty for fellowships or also your residency?
Right. This is a very, very significant question. And it plays itself out at several stages in your career. So, for example, first time it comes up is when you're picking residency. Let's say you can get into a Shabbos program, or you can get into another program that's like far, far superior, but it's not a Shabbos program. Is that the right thing to do? So now, this becomes something that is a lengthy give and take discussion with the Rav, because there's a lot of factors that go into it. Just what is motivating you towards this thing? Is it really that much better that you think that it has a tangible outcome effect on your career, right? And for the most part, on the residency level, I personally rarely think a person should give up the Shabbos program for one of those. It's just not going to make that big a difference, especially if you're going to be specializing in something anyway. However, your real question is at that next level, here it becomes you're now committing to a lifetime career. So I asked this shaila, I had this shaila, obviously. And it was part of the shaila that I went to Rabbi Willick with at that time. And that's when he said to me, he said, you will never be Mechal Shabbos. That was number one. So in terms of that, you're going to be working in the halacha. I've heard from Poskim, including Rabbi Willick and others, they will allow this decision to be guided by a strong desire and passion for a particular field. Other poskim, without his permission, I shouldn't mention the name at this point, but I can tell you privately. Other poskim have said they have a different threshold to this. They say you can go to the non-Shabbos option, right, or the more troublesome for Shabbos option, if there is, let's say, in training, let's say it's just last night, I got a call from a guy who's going into adult cardiology, and he wants to make a decision between going to, somebody offered him in his fellowship, which is pretty good, he must be very good, Shabbos, that's very, very unusual, right? It's a certain hospital, I won't mention it because it's not such a great hospital. Obviously, they're offering Shabbos, so, you know, that usually means it's a marker that it's not that great. And he can go to this fantastic hospital. So we got into a whole discussion on this issue, and I told him the view I just told you. I said, some poskim will say to you, you know, that you can, if you really can show and honestly express that there's going to be a tangible difference in the way you practice your field, right, which would mean, you know, let's say, for me, going to the fellowship I went to, they do 800 surgeries a year compared to one that might have given me Shabbos. Well, no one was going to. But let's say the analogous thing here would be to 50 surgeries a year. That's a very big difference in experience. That person will be a better doctor coming out of there. Or there's a modality that they don't have, like a facet to your career that you're not going to get. In cardiology, this is an analogy. Like, let's say you want to be an electrophysiologist, you want to be an interventionalist. These are all different types of people that you get no training in place A and yes training in place B. These poskim will let you take the non-Shabbos option under those conditions. At the end of the day, it's a real serious shiloh that you need to sit down with the Selah Harav, whoever the poskim is going to be, and you go through it and you weigh it, and they help. You know, there's a bias. You know, you're dying to do it, right? So you need somebody just to keep you in, you know, on an even, neutral, halachically minded keel. And then they can then work through, and it's a case-by-case thing, but there are definitely situations where you can make that move.
Should people now consider surgical residencies?
I mean, because it's impossible not to be... It's a very difficult field to go into, I have to say. I would never say a blanket, you can't do this thing. It's going to always depend on the details, and it'll depend on the person. You know, let's say this person's destined to be the greatest surgeon in the world. I think that might make a difference. Others wouldn't. There are poskim that would say, forget it, right? I think that, you know, on this shiloh, it's the same answer. And you have to really sit down with, you know, the posik that you're usually going to be talking to. I just, as my head, I'm going through now, he would say, forget it, you're crazy, you're not going to be Mahal Shabbos. This posik will be open to discussing the thing much more. I can tell you who's who. I think it's not shocking if you had to. Because, yeah.
What's the hetcher that allows Kohanim to go into medicine?
First of all, you're assuming there is one. But I'll tell you the truth. I never thought there was one. But I won't mention his name, but there is a very accepted posik that under certain conditions allows it. So I'll give you the analysis. It works like this. It's only in the United States. Very, very difficult for Eretz Yisrael because Rove of... what's the problem for a Kohen is the anatomy one, right? And Rove of the cadavers in America are considered non-membrous. And the halacha legabe tumas Kohen is much lighter there, which I'll explain in a minute. In Eretz Yisrael is a big problem unless you have to go to a place where they make sure... Either if you're calling, if you're going to do this, that you don't have to go to an anatomy lab, which nowadays, by the way, is doable. In certain places, you can make that kind of arrangement, believe it or not. But otherwise, it's much more difficult than Eretz Yisrael. Here, we start with the fact that we're assuming the cadavers are non-benevolous. Why does that help? Because Tumas Kohanim has three elements, right? Masa, Maga, and Ohel. You can't touch, you can't move, and you can't be in the room. It's an Isser Daraisa. So it's a very serious Isser. How did the Kohanim then possibly get to an anatomy lab? So rule number one is everybody agrees that the din by a non-Bnei Bris is the same Maga and Masa. That just like you can't touch a Jewish body or move a Jewish body, you can't touch or move a non-Jewish body. The big Shaila is Ohel. Ohel is the machlokes between Tosfos and the Rambam about whether or not it applies to non-Jewish cadavers. We end up paskening like the Rambam, really, that we should be machber. But the lashon that the machaber and the Rama use when they talk about this, yesh zaher, yesh lahachmir, they have a lashon that doesn't sound like it's a straight, flat out iser. So that opens up for the poskim the possibility b'shas adchak we could be mekil on ohel. So therefore, while poskim like Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shechter will say under no conditions are you allowed as a kohen to practice medicine or go into medicine, that's what Delta. It's black and white, very firm. Rav Moshe has one of the most very very striking tshuvos on this issue. It's very strong language. He thinks it's ridiculous, whatever. However, there's a posek that surprised me, because I had two kohanim, they were Torah Shari guys, actually, and they wanted to go into medicine. And I grew up on Rav Shechter and this sock, so I was really discouraging them, telling them no, but I felt so bad. He was coming out, and they're very passionate, he wants to do it. Oh, my whole life, this is what I'm meant to be, what am I going to do, jump off the bridge. I go, all right, take it easy. And I said, let's work it out. And I got this other posik, whose name I won't mention because I don't want people shopping for a heter. So I didn't know that he was going to be maker. I said, let's learn the sugya together. So we learned the sugya, all the stuff I just told you. And I said, you see, if it's shas adchak and you don't touch and you don't move, you can be in the room. And that could work. But is it shas adchak? Is your passion to be a doctor equivalent of shas adchak? I was thinking, no way. I said, go, you. This is for gadol. This is my shoulders are too small. Ask this posik. And he told me yes. Well, I was blown away because I wasn't expecting that to be the answer. But he did tell him this. If in the middle of medical school they make you touch, you must quit. Because that's an Isser D'oraisa. So that was the only caveat to the whole thing, but they managed to do it. And it's based on that kind of hetter. So if you're going into it for the money, the Kohen better not do it, right? It has to be something where this is their avoda. This person's avoda, you know, that's passionate and going to be something that they really are motivated to change shemayim, et cetera, et cetera. Under those conditions, this particular posik was actually not doing it. The vast majority, not. The chatchila would discourage it. Completely, it's really not. There's plenty of other things to do in life, but they felt this was the only thing for them, and so under those conditions, there's a limited group.
Can a firm psychiatrist or psychologist give psychiatric clearance to somebody who wants to undergo something politically problematic, like gender reassignment surgery or physician-assisted suicide? Is it like maybe there? Or
that's such a contemporary Shiloh. It's 100% Lifneiver. In my opinion. Lifneiver.
Okay,
yes, you asked that, yeah. I mean, it's not Lifneiver because it's not Trey Avid de Nahara. You know what I'm referring to. Right? There's an Isser D'oraisa called Lifneiver, but it's only an Isser D'oraisa if there's no other way they can do it other than through you. Right? It's the Nazir on the other side of the river. But if it's Chal Avid de Nahara, which this is, because they'll just go to someone else that will take care of that. Then it's just the Isser D'Rabbanan called Mesayel Over Avera or Lifnei Iver D'Rabbanan or something like that. So either way, I would say it's Asur. Nobody can facilitate another person. You know, Kol Yisrael Arim Zevazer, we're as responsible for each other's neshamos. Can't allow someone else to do something to, you know,
Chas V'Chalil. Can you refer them to somebody else, or that's even?
I wouldn't. I would try to talk them out of it. I would. You know, look, it's, I'm not qualified to discuss this issue. I totally admit. In other words, I'm sure it's a very difficult and difficult both emotionally, difficult to understand the dynamic of it altogether. So I'm not going to profess that I should be commenting on this in terms of what that person should do directly to intervene. But as a general rule, I'm always trying to keep people within halakha and not outside Allah. So whatever I could do in that regard, I would do. I would try to help them. I would definitely embrace them. I would not ostracize them or ever anything like that. Bring them in. They're, you know, obviously whatever the issues are, it's something that they need to deal with. I would help them in any way I can, be happy, well-adjusted, and help them. But not do what they're saying.
follow-up, is that the same for neighbors and non-neighbors, or...?
It depends. No, because if a non-bnei bris is not... There is lifnei iver legabe non-bnei bris. There is a din of lifnei iver for things that are usher to them. So you can't, right? In Avodah Zarah and Bafav in several places, they discuss all this about non-Jews, right? But certain things are not, right? Sirus is a problem. But other things, most things that are usher to us are not usher to them. And those, there's not a lifnei iver because it's not usher to them.
She mentioned serious
and assisted suicide. Right. Suicide, like, suicide is usher. It's usher for a ben Noach too. Right? So it's pasuk actually is by Noach. Right? Shofech dam adam ba adam damo yishafach. Right? So you learn a lot of things from that pasuk. One of them is suicide. Maybe it's on you. Sorry.
How do you deal with
DNRs? DNRs is has six approaches in halacha, literally six approaches. But we'll narrow it down to three. There are what I call the Rabbi Bleich Tzitzeliezer extreme approach. Their approach to DNR, and then I'll say what I do. Right. First, you got to know what's out there in halacha. So Rabbi Bleich is very famous for being extremely limiting in terms of DNR. He doesn't. There's almost no reason to do a DNR in Rabbi Bleich's halachic view. You always have to do everything, really, to save the person. The Tzitz Eliezer, very similarly. At the other extreme is actually Rav Schechter, is one of the most flexible poskim when it comes to DNR. And in the middle, the Rav, I would say, is Rav Moshe, Rav Shlomo Zalman. That's where I am. I basically follow what they advise. So they advise the following. Under no conditions can you ever actively... assist somebody's suicide. So that's starters. Is there ever room to have a DNR? Yes, there is, unfortunately. There are situations where a person has a terminal illness and all you're doing is prolonging pain. Rav Moshe writes, Aser. It's Aser to do that. It's Aser to prolong someone's life if it's just going to be a life of pain and there's no hope for cure. Rav Shlomo Zalman doesn't use as much strong language as Aser as not. He just says, we don't do that. Right, you don't do that. So, but they say that nutrition, hydration, are TV. You know, they use that expression, which Rav Schechter can't stand. You know, like Rav Schechter is very opposed to that. He says, "What's TV? How's this more TV than medicine?" Or this? He has a good point. I get it, but I like Rav Shlomo Zalman or Moshe's approach for a different reason. As a doctor, I feel that. You know, oxygen, hydration, and nutrition, right? What's your goal with someone who has a terminal illness that you can't cure is to palliate, to make them as comfortable as possible. To me, you know, starving to death or having a, you know, thirst to death or suffocating to death is the most painful thing in the world. So I would never, ever withhold that. And hospices try to get you to do it. They try to get you to hold off, to hasten things a little. Right, and the other thing that comes up is morphine. Morphine can hasten also, and it's a very famous psak of Shlomo Zalman that's kedai to know about. That you're allowed to give morphine to help somebody who's in a lot of pain, despite the fact that you know it actually might hasten their end, because you're doing it to relieve them of the pain. You can't obviously give them a lethal dose, you know, without crazy, but you're allowed to use it. So the DNR here would be don't do intubation, don't do CPR. And in this setting, it's an acceptable approach. Now, I don't know if that was your question. That's how I handle DNR myself in, let's say, advising people. What becomes a real problem for people in medicine, let's say, in training, in house staffs have this problem a lot, is let's say there's somebody who has a DNR that you don't feel is a halachic DNR. It's an inappropriate DNR from a halachic perspective. Your posek told you this is not when you do DNR. And it's a Jew, and they code. And there's a din called Lo Tama L'Adam Re'echa. What are you supposed to do, right? You have a chiyuv to save them, right? But you'll also get fired if you touch them, and maybe also put in jail or something for doing it, right? Because DNRs have like legal standing. So this is a big shaila that came up, and the poskim Rav Yashuv and others said you don't have to do it. You can shev al tasa. You don't have to worry about the tamad al mariach under those conditions. That's another good one to know about because it does come up. Does that answer basically the question? Okay. Anything else?
This isn't strictly halakhic, but how do you, guide people in like learning, like in medical school and beyond? Like, how does that manage?
Reminds me of a good story. Okay. You live long enough, you get a lot of stories, especially if you like you hang out in medicine. Medicine's full of stories. I was pre-med, right? And I met this incredible person. He's a doctor. I have to say his name because I love him so much. He's a Lamed Vavnik. I hope I'm not embarrassing him if he ever hears this. His name is Dr. Ricky Goldfarb. Anyone happen to know him before I continue talking about him? He's one of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. He's actually the chairman of nuclear medicine at Beth Israel Hospital. And when I was in college, so he lived near where I was, and I didn't go to YU, so he figured I'm not learning. So he would grab guys from my school, right, and get them to learn, right? So here I was a pre-med, very avid pre-med. What do pre-meds like to do? We like to get things, you know, to put on our applications and stuff, right? So I wanted to, you know, intern by him and get some nice recommendation, maybe some experience in nuclear medicine. I actually had this crazy idea I'd go into radiology back then, right? But I come in, he sits me down, puts me in a room. This was my internship. He says, here, he hands me an Aruch HaShulchan. He says, I want you to take this tape recorder. Everyone know what a tape recorder is? It's this ancient device, right? And I would have to tape and translate the whole Aruch HaShulchan. So I did that for like a year. That was my job. So he was machshiv learning. He used to get me up at 5:30, learn Shemir Shabbos Gilchasa in the mornings. He was an amazing guy. And no one's machshiv learning more than him. So here I am graduating college. I'm going off to medical school. And I said to him, Ricky, what should I do? Tell me, what should I learn in medical school? So you know what he said? Medicine. And then it hit me. Well, that's chachma. He's right. In other words, the first thing to answer this question, it's a good question, but the first thing you got to realize, and this is what I told those Einstein guys that were having three siddurim a day, you got to learn medicine. You made a commitment. Look, you know, it's important to learn. You know, at least that's what I tell the Shrive guys when I'm not talking about medicine. But I really mean it. It's obviously the primary vocation of a Jew is learning all the time. But the way Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal would always say, you know, say Tarascha Kival, when he learned that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, he said it means make it primacy, give it primacy. It doesn't mean that you're doing it the most of your time, but it's always your most important thing that when you're able to, you'll do it. But if you chose to go into medicine and not learn, not either sit and learn or not go to chinuch, it means that you determined, the only heter to go into medicine is if you determined that this is my avoda. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to help people in this way. You have an achrayus to do it really, really well. So you need to realize that should be your first thought, no matter how much you love learning. And I can relate. I loved learning. But when I was in medical school, I learned medicine. And I learned, but I had to modify. You know, anyone who wants to try it knows how I feel about Bikias versus Ian, right? I'm like, I only like Ian. I don't really like Bikias so much. It's like it's good for getting facts, but you know, it's not fun. But I realized that in medical school, I'm not going to have time to do proper Bikias, you know? So I did Bikias, which worked out well because I went through a bunch of mesechtos that way. But I realized that you know it's going to have its time. So in terms of deciding what you're going to learn, I would not give up learning. If you stop learning for 4 years completely, that's a big mistake. I'm not saying to do that. I'm saying you're going to have to modify the level and quantity of learning. And you have to realize that unless you're a gaon, it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain the type of learning you might have been used to, let's say, even as a pre-med. Ironically, you know, people make the mistake as pre-meds, they give up learning. That's a mistake. That Ricky Goldfarb would never let you do. Right? He didn't let me do it, and I think it's a bad idea. Obviously, it's competitive, and you got to do well, etc., but people overdo it, I think, as pre-meds, and they do a lot of fluffy things that they don't need to do in terms of the extracurriculars and all that, and that should be a big learning time. Those are the best learning years here at YU. It's this institution of great learning. So, but in medical school, I would like look for a project. Now, a nice project is, by the way, to learn as much halacha that you're going to need to deal with as you become a resident and a physician afterwards. And, you know, go through Nishmas Avram, have like a chabura in that. That would be a great thing to do. You know, that I think is ideal. If you, you know, you have to be up to it. It's good in a chabura setting. And if you could like take turns going into the background of each of the halachas, then it really would come to... But, you know, make sure you're learning good medicine and then do that as well.
Kind of a follow-up to that. So you don't think that, like, in undergrad or when you're in yeshiva currently, that you should, like, look and stumble into these studies that are going to come up in...
No, yeah, you should. Sooner the better. The sooner the better. Yeah. Absolutely.
Even if it's going to sacrifice potentially on your learning and, you know, the limited amount of hours learning.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question.
When you start...
Yeah, because something has to give.
Right.
You know, yeah, something has to give. Especially if you want to get some grades that will get you in. I have to say that... you know, the Chafetz Chaim in his Hakdama to the Mishnah Berurah, he says the most important learning is a limud or maybe the lidei masa, right? Because at the end of the day, we have to really know halacha first and foremost in terms of our limud. It's like a very foreign concept in many yeshivas, but it happens to be true, especially. You know, let's say, so a person could feel, if they're not going into medicine, you know, or a chayim, you're pretty good, right? You know, aleph, beis, gimel, dal, hey, bab, in the Mishnah Berurah, that's pretty good, and that's sufficient. For medicine, you really need to know more than that. You really need to know a lot of things. How many people have to deal with ksiva on Shabbos, right? I remember when I do Hillel Shabbos in Torah Shraga in the afternoon, so I'm always like saying to myself, should I do ksiva with them? It has nothing to do with them, right? Unless, you know, but us, we really have to know about co-save and what constitutes co-save. Is like writing on a computer, is that co-save? Is writing numbers or symbols? You have to know all the details of that malacha, and that's just a tiny little example. It is kedai, I think, as at least a night seder or something to dedicate it. I wouldn't give up the Ian, because you're never going to get Ian opportunities like this again. You know, to have great Rosh Yeshiva, have a safe. So I wouldn't give up that morning, but instead of doing more Bikias at night, I would probably dedicate it to something like this. Many people, I did it that way. And many people do. Many people do. So it's Kedai. When's our official ending time? Oh, okay, we got 5 minutes. Yeah.
What do you tell people when they ask you for advice on life planning in conjunction with, you know, when they plan medical school, getting married, having children, and financial considerations? What's your general address?
I would answer it like this: the decision, whatever that whole discussion should be done with. Let's say you're married or not married. See, I have a. Maybe someone from Mechila might remember this. I had this as one of my. Machshava discussions is the following, that, you know, ordering your life, right? I have this shir that I give. It's called Ordering Your Life. And one of my favorite gemaras, this gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Gimel, says, what does Hashem, remember this? Remember, what does Hashem do with his day, kivyachol, 12-hour day? So, right, I got this from the idea from Rav Shechter, because he used it for something. And then I just expanded it, that it says Hashem is kovei itim l'Torah for the first quarter, and then he does chesed the second, then he does parnasa, and then he misachek b'lev yasa, right? And v'halachla b'dracha, this is a model for us. Our life should consist of Torah, chesed, achrayis for parnasa, and a necessary downtime to, you know, retain our sanity, right? And to do the other avoda. It becomes an avoda itself because it facilitates the primary avoda. But, so, and then it's not 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%. Everybody's different on how they divvy it up. It's very much the natiya of the person will dictate how much of each they should be doing. So one point, and this is the point I was getting at, you do that for yourself. You get an idea of who you are. Then that makes for good shidduchim, right? You figure out, where am I on those percentages? And then you try to go out with a girl, and the girl tries to go out with a guy, who matches, complements each other. Because what I'm getting at, that ultimate decision is got to be the couple. That's in the ideal. Because, and I'm not saying who does what and which goes what, that you have to figure out. But at the end of the day, that it's such a complicated question because of this. Because, you know, you have to know your give and how much flexibility you have in these areas. You make sure you have those four components. You should have, you know, components of Talmud Torah, Chesed, Achrayas for Parnasa, which means not being rich. Right? Is this like, is that the kind of thing you say in a doctor audience? Not being rich? You know, you might hear, once you start doing like internships and stuff, you're going to hear a lot of doctors whining about how bad it's gotten. Right? It used to be so good, it used to make so much money for doing nothing. And now we have to do something to make not so much money. Right? That's the kind of thing they say. It's a big exaggeration. Medicine is a very lucrative field. I'll tell you right now. I'm in yeshiva most of the year, right? But I work here, what, 3 months a year in total, something like that. And that parnasa is more than most people in Eretz Yisrael make ever. Right? It's but the people in Eretz Yisrael are very happy. Very happy. Yeah, there is a sort of mindset that is not a healthy one that says, I got to make the most money I can make. No, what you should do is make enough money to be secure and stable, right? And that's that. Then you should focus on your avoda, which is all the rest of it, you know? And, you know, you should have a nice, large family, and it should be a bracha, and you should have time with them, and you should spend a lot of time with them, and you should spend a lot of time with your wife, etc. Those are very important components. You should be passionate about the medicine you do, l'shem shamayim, and to help people, and not worry about the economics of it, really. There isn't I won't mention specific fields, but even the least lucrative fields do better than 90% of jobs. They really do. So at least in the United States. And a couple of fields in Israel actually do well. General pediatrics, it's ironic. The least lucrative field here is probably general pediatrics side. Over there is the most. I don't understand why that's true, but it is.
Well, a lot of girls want to know the deal with skirts and scrubs.
Ah, good question. So what's wrong with girls wearing pants altogether, right? So there are three potential problems. And this, all three, according to the Rav Rosner and the Shevet HaLevi, the Tzitz Eliezer, and the Minchas Yitzchak, these are the three heavy-hitting gedolim, say all three of these are applied. One is klei geber, you know, it's man's clothing. The other is pisuk raglayim, it separates the legs. And the third is just general tznius, it's not tzanua. So a lot of other poskim, including Rav Avadji Yosef, and others say, no, you know, klei geber is my name. It's not considered klei geber because it's like very common for women to wear pants. So that's not a problem. So what's the problem? And pisuk raglayim is also a big debate. It's really tznius, is it tzanu or not? There's a famous Rav Henkin Yedua Shita that it's not a problem if it's tzanua. And you could actually wear pants if it's done in a tzanua way. You know, baggy, not tight, not in any way. So all this is nice, and it'll come in the end, but the problem is that scrubs are very not tzanua, both top and bottom, right? The top of scrubs is just, you know, certainly the sleeves are no good. Even if you hold it, you're okay above the elbow, right, as long as it's tight, but scrubs are the opposite. They're completely exposing a person, right, and at the neck. And the pants are also, unless you get extra sizes big, which is the solution for some people, also a problem. So scrubs is a big problem. It's a legitimate, real problem. The solutions, though, exist. And the solutions are generally the following. One, in terms of the top, you should wear something underneath. And that's, you know, tzanua. And that should be okay. Most hospitals will not have a problem with that. The other is there's something called a skirt scrub. And these things are actually available. You know, just go online and you can see. You can get them in various styles and whatever. And that's another possibility. And then the third possibility is the hospital gown that you could just wear around it, which a lot of people do. Now, all of this is great up to the point you have to go into the OR In the OR, it's not happening. You know, you got to go in and scrubs in the OR. So now what do you do? That's maybe a real question, right? What? Right, so that's an option. That if they, you know, if that's allowed. At the end of the day, if you're forced to wear scrubs under some conditions, then do what Rav Henkin. I would be okay with it personally. You have to ask your Rav, whatever. But if push comes to shove, there's a number of poskim that are okay after going through that whole hierarchy of possibilities, that as long as the scrubs themselves are tsanua, meaning like baggy and not clingy and not in a way that's inappropriate. So it is a passable problem. It's a real problem. Everyone should recognize that it's an issue.
What about head covering during surgery, either with a kippa or like a kisser roche?
Definitely should do it, but you have to cover your hair and there anyway. Right? In Israel, they got the Israeli surgical caps are better for a woman who's covering her hair. So it's not a problem. Sometimes in America, it's, you know, completely the fetist covering of the hair because it's like completely see-through or flimsy. So that's easy to rectify as well. Just wear more than one of them. They'll never fault you for being too covered up. Just not enough. Right? And I'm saying from a medical perspective, not from the sneeze perspective. Okay, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun. It was really good.
Are you going to upload to my store?
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much.
I like it.